Smallwood versus Commonwealth. D. Eric Wisely, Appellants Counsel. Brittany Marie Jones, Deputy Solicitor General for the Commonwealth.
All right, I see Ms. Jones and I see Mr. Wisely. Do both of you have the ability to hear me speak?
I do, Your Honor.
Yes? All right. Mr. Wisely, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
And the reason I'd like to reserve so much is I believe the court has answered the issues that I raised on appeal on the 12th of January of this year when it amended Rule 1:24, subsection D, changing that language from may to must. I raised this in my brief. The fact is that change brought rules into compliance with Bearden v. Georgia. Bearden v. Georgia is a case directly on point. It's almost identically factual. In that case, a man like Smallwood, who was not had not even graduated the 10th grade, entered a plea of guilt and under a first offender statute. A judgment of guilt was not entered at that time. Instead, the matter was deferred under their first offender statute, during which time Mr. Bearden failed to completely pay his court costs and fines. Mr. Bearden also failed to pay some restitution. There are other few minor details that were different. But the bottom line is the court in that case held very clearly that what the trial court in this case and what the Court of Appeals affirmed is simply not constitutional. In that case,
what case are you referring to?
Bearden v. Georgia, Your Honor.
Well, counsel.
Counsel.
Yes.
No, please.
Go ahead, Justice McCullough.
Well, so, I mean, one difference looking at the Georgia case is that he was laid off and he was unable to find other work. Am I correct? The record in this case shows your client was employed. Now, he had some obligations like child support. He had to pay his rent and so on. But isn't that a difference? Is that he has a job, he has steady income, and he apparently he's not paying anything. So it's not like he's saying, here's what I can do, $1, $5, whatever.
No, I'm glad
that's what the facts of your case as opposed to that one.
Actually, if you look back at the record, Judge Napier and Judge Athey, there were two different judges who viewed this. Judge Athey, when he sat on the case and the continuances, he explored those issues on those dates. When Judge Athey came in at the last court date and said, well, have you paid it? And then without sua sponte, without being asked to do so, he simply found him guilty without exploring his financial ability. And I think the record is rife with counsel at that time, which was me, telling the court he's an indigent man. He has $26,000. He was actually in jail at the time. He had no prior felony criminal history. At the time he was in jail, and I apologize for exploring facts. I didn't expect to explore facts in this detail. But at the time he was, he came before the circuit court for this first offender status. He'd never had a felony charge. He was in jail for $26,000 of arrears on his child support.
Is that in the record?
It is in the record, yes, Your Honor. He was actually being held on the date of the grand jury. We set it out. When we came back to court, he was found. We entered the plea agreement. The fact is, what the Commonwealth mistakes over and over again, we do not object to the fact that court costs were imposed on this man under 19.2-303.4. The bottom line is, what that court was not able to do under Bearden, under 19.2-354, under every law that the Court of Appeals said it had gave this a bell curve analysis of the things that the trial court could do.
Mr. Wisely, this is Justice Kelsey. The reason why the Court of Appeals did that is there's about a half a dozen cases from our court saying that when you're in an abuse of discretion standard, reasonable jurists on the same issue can still be reasonable and come to opposite conclusions. So your criticism of that turn of phrase is a criticism against our court's understanding of the conceptual boundaries of discretion.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals and the trial court both ignored the statutory framework that follows 19.2-303.4. It ignored 19.2-354, 358. What that court could have done, if it found that my client was willfully not paying his paying back those court costs, it was permitted 60 days of contempt to be imposed on my client. What's not statutorily available to the trial court and on affirmance under 18.2-251 was conviction for that charge. 18.2-251 includes the terms that will trigger conviction very clearly. What the plea agreement said was not that he would be convicted if he failed to pay his court costs in a timely manner or within a year. What it said was the dismissal would not occur unless his court costs were paid in full.
Yes, counsel, I have two questions.
Yes,
I want to go back to Justice McCullough's question with regard to Bearden. Why doesn't the November 13th, 2017 hearing satisfy any Bearden requirement? Bearden basically says if the court finds that the probationer has failed to make sufficient bona fide efforts, and I don't want to get too far in the weeds on the facts, but at that November 13th hearing, it became clear that your client had some discretionary funds. The court could find that he had some discretionary funds to make some payments. So why doesn't that hearing satisfy Bearden?
Number one, under Bearden, it says it was unanimous. There were two different reasons the majority and the concurrence gave, but they were unanimous that there had to be an exploration of those reasons, of those facts, why he could not make the payments. There was no exploration on that November date in 2017. None.
How can you say that when there was a discussion of how much money he has coming in, how much money he has going out, and your client makes the statement that he will basically make the payments by the next continuance date?
With all due respect, at that point, was the available remedy for the court was 60 days of contempt. That's
let's explore that. Let's explore that. You've argued continuously that the option under 251 that it was a dismissal. The only option the court had was a dismissal.
I said deferral was also available. Continuance was also available, which is what the court had done on four prior occasions. I apologize, Ron. I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's okay, and I'm glad you raised the point that the court had done that on four prior occasions. If the case is not dismissed in criminal world everywhere, isn't the flip side that the defendant is convicted?
Judge, if you look at the law that the Court of Appeals ignored when it flippantly asks me or says why I would suggest that the matter can remain on the docket indefinitely, it cannot remain on the docket indefinitely.
Interrupting you again.
Sure.
What was flippant about the Court of Appeals? You're using rhetoric that requires more explanation than what you're giving, at least from my perspective. What did the Court of Appeals do that was flippant?
The Court of Appeals suggested that my argument, mischaracterized my argument, and said that I said that this matter would have to remain on a docket indefinitely if he wasn't to make a complete payment of his court costs. That's not what I argued. In fact, that would be an argument in derogation of the clear law that I've set forth on brief that any collection has to occur within 60 years. That's not my language. That's what the General Assembly has said. The problem in this case is that it violates the statute in Virginia, which is in compliance with Bearden v. Georgia, that says that you cannot throw someone in jail solely, someone who's complied with every other part of 18.2-251. You can't put him in jail unless you find that he is doing it willfully. And once you decide you're going to put him in jail, and that's available to him, to the courts under 19.2-354 and 358. But once you decide to do that, what you do not have the option to do under 18.2-251 is convict him. So he can't be convicted for court costs alone because court costs were contained in 18.2-251. And you can see that if you look at the way the Court of Appeals obfuscated its own law in Nunez. What it said in Nunez was, under 18.2-251, there is a clear provision for drug treatment. Drug treatment is a part of 18.2-251. What Nunez said, he's never going to be able to get that complete. That's term and condition under 18.2-251. So we don't have to leave it on the docket forever for him to complete something that is contained in 18.2-251. Come forward in this case. There is nothing in the 18.2-251 about court costs. In fact, that's contained in an entirely different section under an entirely different statutory framework under 19.2-303.4 and everything after. And under what the trial court could have done in that case is 60 days of contempt. It would have been something I would have fought against because my client was $26,000 in.
And can you give me an appendix site for that, counsel? Because I looked at page 52 of the appendix. I saw there were some details about his expenses. The $26,000 figure, I just don't remember seeing.
May I, would I be out of line to ask that I give you that on rebuttal after, while
sure.
I...
Sure, oh yeah, that's fine, absolutely.
Thank you. I will find that and actually, if the court would...
I know it's a ticky-tacky point, but it, you know, the point is, if the record shows an ability to pay that for whatever reason he's not doing versus he literally has no ability to pay, those are different things.
No, I understand, Your Honor, and if the court would allow me to...
No, that's fine. Please continue with it.
Mr. Wisely, you have 3 minutes and 39 seconds.
I'd like to reserve that time, please, and so that I can answer judge's question.
Yes. All right, Mr. McRoberts.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Brittany Jones here today on behalf of the Commonwealth.
All right. All right. Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, Your Honor. Can you hear me, Chief Justice?
Yes.
Okay. The most important thing to understand about this case is that Mr. Smallwood voluntarily agreed, with the benefit of counsel, to pay costs within a one-year period as a condition of obtaining dismissal of a felony drug charge under the statutory first offender program. This agreement was negotiated, as evidenced by the handwritten markings on the plea agreement itself, markings specifically initialed by Mr. Smallwood, and never questioned until the terms were enforced against him nearly 2.5 years later. The terms of this agreement are clear. It says, and this is at JA-29, defendant's finding of guilt and the disposition of the matter shall be deferred for 1 year, during which time the defendant shall be subject to the following terms and conditions. Condition number 6 is that the defendant shall pay all court costs and the cost of any programs as ordered by her probation officer. The agreement then indicates that this contemplates a statutory first offender disposition under section 18.2-251. This statute itself states that upon violation of a term or condition, the court may enter an adjudication of guilt and proceed as otherwise provided. Now, Mr. Smallwood argues that this agreement makes payment a condition of dismissal, but not a term or condition of eligibility for the first offender program. That simply makes no sense. First of all, Mr. Smallwood's reading of the plea agreement would mean that violation of any of the listed terms and conditions, there are 7 of them, would mean the court could not dismiss the case, but also could not find Mr. Smallwood guilty, because, in Mr. Smallwood's view, the listed plea conditions are conditions precedent only to dismissal and not to a finding of guilt. That means that if Mr. Smallwood, for example, refused a search or failed to submit to a substance abuse assessment, the trial court could do nothing but continue the case and hope that Mr. Smallwood eventually complied. If Mr. Smallwood is right about that, the trial court would be left in an indefinite limbo, unable to dismiss the case, but also unable to find Mr. Smallwood guilty for failing to abide by the terms of his agreement with the Commonwealth. Clearly, that is not what the parties intended, nor is it what the trial court would have intended when it adopted the plea agreement, nor what the General Assembly contemplated when it adopted the deferred disposition statute. As the plain terms of the agreement suggest, the parties intended that the terms and conditions listed in the plea be terms and conditions of Mr. Smallwood's eligibility for the first offender program. If Mr. Smallwood violated those terms, he was not entitled to dismissal of the underlying charge under the first offender program, and the deferred finding of guilt would become a permanent finding of guilt.
Ms. Jones, will you stop just a moment? If there's somebody on this line that is not muted, and you're also not speaking, will you please mute your line? Go ahead, Ms. Jones.
Sure. Mr. Smallwood's alleged understanding of the plea agreement also fails for another reason. It is not clear that a plea agreement even could create a condition precedent to dismissal that was not also a term and condition of the first offender disposition. And that's because the first offender statute requires dismissal of the case when the terms and conditions of the first offender probation have been satisfied. The statute says that the trial court, quote, shall discharge the person and dismiss the proceedings upon fulfillment of the terms and conditions. A plea that prevented the trial court from doing so would be at odds with the statute. Mr. Smallwood's reading of the plea thus not only creates absurd results, it also puts the plea at loggerheads with the statute. And again, there is no reason to believe the parties and the trial court intended that result. Mr. Smallwood points to
the- Let me ask you this. What is your understanding of what the record reflects with respect to his ability to pay? I mean, there's some data points about he has some income, but then he's being held in contempt for child support, and then he has some expenses like rent and child support. Anyway, just help me with that basic point.
Sure, Your Honor. I think the $28,000 that my friend on the other side referenced was the amount, the purge amount that Mr. Smallwood was asked to pay for child support obligations at the very beginning of the case. And that was the reason why he was held in contempt for a period of time. But ultimately, the numbers that you sort of referenced later with respect to his income and child support obligations and rent, I think encompass all of that because his wages were being garnished to pay his child support obligations at that time. So I think that's really the sort of relevant data we have with respect to his income.
Because I mean, even assuming this is analogous to Bearden, and it is different because in Bearden, the court imposes a fine after a guilty plea. This was a term of him agreeing, I'll plead guilty and here's the term. So that's a conceptual difference. But even if we clear that hurdle, it seems to me the record, if someone is saying I can't pay, then on appeal, I need a record that shows I can't pay, as opposed to him just saying, I can't pay. I mean, there needs to be evidence to support the point. So even if you make the conceptual leap, I think there's still a evidentiary presentation that has to be satisfied in order to even be in the fight on this due process point.
That's right, Your Honor. And I think there's sort of three reasons why Bearden doesn't control in this case. I think the first is the one that you mentioned about the plea agreement. And I think that's really an important point because Bearden doesn't speak to whether or not a defendant can voluntarily obligate himself to pay costs and whether a court can then hold the person to that agreement at a later point. So I think that sort of in and of itself distinguishes Bearden. But I do think there's a second problem, which is that in Bearden, you had evidence that the individual's financial situation had deteriorated over time. And here, I think you have the exact opposite. When Mr. Smallwood first entered into this plea agreement, he was incarcerated, he didn't have employment. And then later on, at one of the continuance hearings, it was made clear that Mr. Smallwood did have a job and he did have some income. So I think you have really the sort of exact opposite situation. And again, I think it's a little bit unfair to the trial court here because Mr. Smallwood at all of these continuance hearings never said, I'm unable to make these payments. In fact, he said the exact opposite to the trial court. He represented that he would make payment by the upcoming date. And so I think to the extent there's sort of a lapse in the record as to what assets Mr. Smallwood may have had or other aspects of his finances, I think that's precisely because he didn't make this argument until the nth hour, 2.5 years after he had entered into this agreement.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey, let me interject there. So let me follow the conceptual logic of that. A contract says I'm going to pay this money by a certain date. And if I do, you'll give me something, in this case, a dismissal. He doesn't pay by a certain date, but he doesn't say he can't pay. Maybe he can't, maybe he can, according to the defendant's present argument. But who has the burden of proof of saying I can't pay versus no, you can pay?
I think, Your Honor, Mr. Smallwood had the burden, in part because he did enter into this agreement voluntarily and with the advice of counsel. And in entering into this agreement, he represented to the court that he was willing and able to make these payments. And so to the extent that situation changed, whether through changed circumstances or for other reasons, it would have been incumbent on him to present that evidence to the court and perhaps ask for a withdrawal of the plea agreement or some other remedy. But I think even in that circumstance, the answer would be to withdraw the plea, not to unilaterally amend the plea because Mr. Smallwood wasn't able to satisfy his obligations under the agreement. Your Honors, I'd also like to return to one point about the court's October 18th, 2016 order, which Mr. Smallwood references as a potential source of confusion because it refers to the usual terms and conditions of probation and the terms listed in open court. But I think in several different ways, this order actually reiterates the requirement that Mr. Smallwood pay costs in order to receive a dismissal. For starters, costs are a usual term and condition of a first offender probation. Indeed, Virginia statute requires courts to impose costs in these circumstances. Secondly, the court adopted the proposed plea agreement in open court. The plea's terms were therefore incorporated into the court's order through its reference to the terms and conditions imposed in open court. And if all that weren't enough, the court also specifically listed cost as a special condition in the order. The court's reference here to a suspended sentence was admittedly a Scrivener's error, but the trial court made clear, and this is at J97, that the listed terms reflected the terms of a first offender probation, not of a suspended sentence. And Mr. Smallwood's subsequent efforts to comply with those conditions make clear that he understood the court's intent, given that there was no suspended sentence in this case. But even if there was any confusion on that front, the confusion was resolved no later than Mr. Smallwood's first post-plea hearing on May 30th, 2017, which was nearly 21 months before the court ultimately convicted Mr. Smallwood of this offense. And at that hearing, the court expressly informed Mr. Smallwood that, quote, whatever the terms of the plea agreement you had, you do need to complete them by the next hearing date, adding specifically that this included the paying of costs. Mr. Smallwood responded, quote, yes, sir, and later informed the trial court that, quote, everything will be completed. This was not Mr. Smallwood's only opportunity to address the issue. At the next hearing, 6 months later, Mr. Smallwood and his attorney again reiterated, not that Mr. Smallwood was unable to make payment, but instead that payment would be forthcoming. And again, I think all in, Mr. Smallwood here had 2.5 years to make this payment. And given that at no point during that 2.5 year period did Mr. Smallwood object on the basis that he was unable to make payment, the trial court was well within its discretion to hold him to the terms of his plea agreement and find that he was ineligible for a first offender dismissal. As one final point, Your Honors, I'd like to note that Mr. Smallwood's plea agreement did contain a waiver of appellate rights. And there was no exception in that agreement for appeals related to a failure to comply with first offender conditions, questions as to the lawfulness of a cost condition, or questions about how to interpret the plea agreement. And this court has repeatedly upheld such waivers as valid. Under this court's precedent, specifically Wolford versus Virginia Department of Taxation, the Commonwealth was not obligated to separately cross appeal this issue. Cross appeals are required only to modify or otherwise change a favorable judgment. And the Commonwealth does not seek to do either here. We therefore believe this waiver provides an adequate and independent basis for affirmance of the judgment below. If the court has no further questions, we ask that you affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
All right. Mr. Wisely, you have 3 minutes and 39 seconds remaining for rebuttal.
Mr. Wisely, please unmute yourself.
I'm not muted. I have not muted myself. I haven't touched anything. I don't think I know how to mute myself. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Somebody told me to unmute myself. Can I start over? I apologize. I heard somebody say unmute myself. Can the court hear me? I apologize.
Yes, I can hear you. I think everybody else can hear you. Go ahead and argue.
Thank you. The issue is not whether the court could impose costs. 19.2-303.4 is clear. It can impose costs. The issue is not whose burden it is to prove that he can't make his costs. Let's assume, arguendo, he can't. The question is what the trial court could do once it finds he's not paid his costs. All I can ask the court is, why do we have 19.2-354, 19.2-356, 19.2-358 if the court's not supposed to use it? The court was supposed to find him in contempt if they found he had a basis to pay. If that's what Judge Nate or Athey decided was the case, that he could pay and wasn't, he could give him 60 days in jail. What he couldn't do, because it's not in 18.2-251, what he couldn't do was convict him of the underlying charge, because that's not a term or condition, as referenced in the Court of Appeals case of Nunez, that would allow the court to simply find him guilty. He did everything he was asked to do, everything except make court cost payments. The next issue, Your Honor, the fact is, the suspended sentence language, what she calls a Scrivener's error in the deferral order, that was brought to the court's attention. It was never addressed. It was never changed. No one's ever changed it. That's not the way that Scrivener's error works. The fact is, my client relied on 19.2-354, 19.2-358. I advised him, this is what's going to happen. You can go to jail for 60 days. Can't convict you because you did everything else you're supposed to do. In a fit of pique, that's what the trial court did. It was annoyed with my client. Perhaps it was justified to be annoyed with my client for having done so. It could have put him in jail for up to 60 days. Instead, it convicted him of his first felony under a first offender statute in violation of Bearden, in violation of the General Assembly's law that specifically addresses it. That is what everything after 19.2-303.4 is intended to address. It gives the courts a way of punishing these people when they don't make their court costs. So let's please set aside the issue of whether he could have paid or not paid. Perhaps he could have, perhaps he could, but if he couldn't pay, the remedy for the court, the remedy for the Commonwealth, which it never asked for, this is sua sponte, the remedy for the court is 60 days in jail, up to 60 days in jail on contempt. The final thing I want to bring up is there was no cross appeal. The Court of Appeals ruled that correctly, that these things can be appealed. It went to this court's white opinion and said so. It went to its own a case of its own. It resolved that issue. There was no cross appeal by the attorney generals on that issue. They did not cross appeal the issue of whether 5A18 in that rule 5A18 rule 5:25 in this court.
Counsel, this is just permit me to interrupt you briefly. We've recently held in the Alexandria case that cross appeals are not necessary from an appellee who is not seeking to change the result below. So does that ruling affect your analysis?
As I pointed out on brief, the fact is that if you're looking at different reasons for, like if you said that this is a Fourth Amendment violation, and then you find a different reason for there not being a Fourth Amendment violation than was raised in the trial court, that's a proper use of the right reason, wrong, the result, wrong reason analysis. What you can't do is go to a completely different issue and say, well, we're not going to cross appeal that. I've gone through this issue because I felt like that should have been cross appealed. And that is the only, the fact is what was brought up was procedural default. The Court of Appeals answered that question. The Attorney General did not cross appeal. If this was me as an appellant.
Fair enough. You've answered my question. Thank you very much, Mr. Wisely.
Thank you, Your Honor. If there's nothing, I'd love to answer any other question if there is one. Otherwise, thank you.
All right. Your time has expired.